This is your class, and there are two ways we can go. What happened was, when Deacon Henry asked me to cover for him when he was going to be in Brantford, the Old Testament lesson was about Jonah, the prophet Jonah. And there's a study on Jonah we could do, but the psalm for that Sunday was Psalm 25. And we could do Psalm 25. It's a good Lenten psalm. In fact, on March 4th, no, today's March 4th. Let me get this right here. Matter of fact, on January 21st, Psalm 25 was the psalm. And so I'm prepared to go either way. We can go with Jonah or the psalm. And the other we can save for later if Deacon Henry asks me again. But
can we go with Jonah?
You want to go, Jonah? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. All right. Let me pass out some things here. Now, Jonah was called to go to Nineveh. You can take these home. I think they're real interesting. They're right out of my favorite research tool, Wikipedia. I spared no expense.
Spared no expense.
Preparing this. So, Jonah was told to go to Nineveh. Now, Jonah lived in the time of King Jeroboam II, which begs the question, who was King Jeroboam I? Well, all the 12 tribes of Israel, were intact under David and Solomon. But toward the end of Solomon's reign, he took all these pagan wives, and they had him worshiping pagan gods. Coincidental to that, or was it coincidental, Solomon's kingdom began to fall apart. And Solomon's son, I forget his name right now, sought counsel of Solomon's advisors on what to do. And they said, don't raise taxes. Whatever you do, don't raise taxes. People out there are already angry that the kingdom's kind of getting fragile. Don't raise taxes. So this young Solomon's son went to his advisors and said, raise the taxes and tell them if Solomon was strict, you're going to be more strict. Well, there were these 10 tribes of the north, the two in the south being a small tribe of Benjamin and Judah. Judah comes into play later on as the tribe from which Jesus came. He's called the Lion of Judah. So these northern 10 tribes began to feel really upset, and whether it was out of just political expediency or whether the guy wanted power, I think it was probably the former. He saw things not getting done. So Jeroboam one politicked and got the 10 northern tribes to separate out from the two southern tribes, the small tribe of Benjamin and the tribe of Judah. So this is all about Jeroboam. You can look him up on Wikipedia. Well, Jonah lived in the time of Jeroboam II. So it was actually the fourth reign after Jeroboam I came along Jeroboam II. And this tells about Jeroboam II, and he's a pretty good king. And by that time, the worship of Yahweh, the God who was so holy you couldn't even say his name, was still pretty much intact. So let me just read through Jonah. Read straight through. God bless him. The people who put together our lectionary years and years ago have done such a wonderful job pairing four scriptures together that all feed one another. And the first one was from the Old Testament, And then the New Testament lesson that day was about forgiveness. Now, I could have marked Jonah in here, but I didn't. Let me look it up. This is the St. Joseph's version, St. Joseph's of the New American Bible. St. Joseph left this at my house. It makes it more sellable, mainly. Anyhow, let me look up Jonah, and we'll read it straight through. And I just has a nice glossary in the front, I mean, a nice direction on where to go to find things. Jonah is what called one of the minor prophets, the major prophets being Isaiah, Jeremiah. They are certainly major prophets, maybe Ezekiel, but anyhow. Jonah's called a minor prophet because it's really not a prophetic book in the sense of like they're trying to tell the future or tell people to get in line in the 12 tribes, but he is named a prophet. And the story goes, so he's a minor prophet, so he's in the back of the Old Testament. He had nothing to say about that. That's just where the old church fathers put him. Let me find it. And again, you can buy this online for $19.99.
Wow.
And it's a great book. It is probably the most researched version of the Bible by Catholic scholars who have written these prefaces, and then along at the bottom come study notes that tell you about what we're reading. I apologize, I should have marked this. I thought we were going to go with the song. We can all do it later. This is just showing my incapacity here. Let me go to the front here. Well, Jonah lived at the time of Jeroboam II. And the practices, as I said, the practices of worshiping the true God Yahweh were still pretty much intact. And so even the northern tribes had a sense of morality. I was just two pages away. Had a sense of morality. So Jonah got a word from the Lord, and this may all be fictitious, but it tells a story. Most good stories have a moral point to them. That is why Star Wars is exciting to people, because it's secular, but it has a moral compass. The bad side of the Force, the good side of the Force. Well, you know, you could say good and evil, God and the devil, but a lot of secular things do pronounce God's plans and God's purposes. There are a lot of songs like that. When Vicki and I were in high school, she went to a Young Life Club in Terry Parker, which is over in the Arlington area, and I went to a Young Life Club at Forest High School. And Young Life is a evangelical Christian movement in the high schools to bring people to faith in Jesus. Now, the decisions like that were made in high school are now being made in middle school. So Young Life is adapted to that by having Young Life for the high schoolers and Wildlife for the middle schoolers. And many of the songs they sing are secular songs, but have a Christian moral point. Rather than hitting the kids, boom, you know, with a hard Christian morality song, we sing secular songs. Well, this may be a secular writing that became included in the Bible. And this is, I'll just read it, okay? the word of the Lord came to Jonah. Now, interesting, there's a lot of irony and humor in here. There's a lot of humor in the Bible that goes past us because it doesn't translate well, you know. But Jonah means dove. The name Jonah in Hebrew means dove, okay? The word of the Lord came to Dove, son of Amittai, set out for the great city of Nineveh, and preached against it, for the wickedness came before me. The wicked, even non-Jewish communities were judged by God as to their morality. Now, they said, well, they never heard the gospel. Well, this is, you know, hundreds of years before the gospel, but Paul says in Romans chapter 1 that people who have not heard the gospel are judged by the law that they knew. But the Jews had no excuse because they had the law. People not having heard the gospel are judged by the law they knew. People who have heard the gospel are judged by the law. And that, you could say the Ten Commandments. You say, oh, well, that was Old Testament. Jesus threw that out. No. Jesus said, I do not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law. So we teach the Ten Commandments to kids today as the nugget of Christian morality. The more full expression of that Christian morality is found in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, 7. If you want to hear Jesus' summary of Christian morality, you go to Sermon on the Mount. Matthew, who wrote from a Jewish point of view, has the Sermon on the Mount as the beginning of Jesus' ministry. Now, John, I called it the cosmic Christ, and Henry said, whoa, you know, New Age, said, well, it's not cosmic like New Age. No, it isn't. But John wrote for the whole entire population of the world. And the first Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are called synoptic Gospels. They're chronological. They tell the story, sort of, in chronological. And then John is more literary, artistic. Maybe takes some literary license, artistic license in his writing. But it's a beautiful gospel. And if someone is interested in Christianity and want to read a gospel, that's a good one to start with. John, it's the cosmic Christ. It's the Christ for the whole world. So the Jews were judged by the law they knew, but Nineveh was going to be judged by the law they knew. Now, Psalm 19, which happens to be our psalm today, says that the law of God is displayed in the universe, just in nature. It talks about nature and how we come to know the law. And it talks about nature, then it segues into a part that says the law of the Lord is perfect, rejoicing the soul. The testimony of the Lord is pure, making wise the simple. So in Mass, we are going to read a little bit of Psalm 19. Not very much, because the brain can only take so much as a seat can stand. And if the Mass goes on for more than an hour, people lose interest. I mean, it's just the way we're built. There's a nerve that goes from the buttock to the brain, and when the buttock gets tired, the brain gets tired. So the Catholic Church learned this long ago. Now, the Bible churches, they'll go on for an hour and a half, 2 hours, 2.5 hours, lots of singing, you know, and lots of preaching, but the people lose interest, you know.
So is that why everybody stands up every now and then?
Yeah, exactly. And you talk to the Bible churches and say, you know, your form of government is really Baptist. Oh, we're not Baptist. We're not Baptist. But in truth, they have a minister who holds a lot of power and a board appointed by the minister And a new minister, new preacher comes into Baptist Church, he will cultivate a board of elders that agree with what he says. And so these new Bible churches, the Canvas Church up here in Alachua, Canvas means they go out from door to door and they find people to run church and bring them in.
Oh, you know what a girl who goes there told me? She said they call it Canvas because each time you create a new...
Oh!
A new self.
A new painting?
Well, they call it that. Like, you're the canvas.
All right.
And by whatever you learn there...
Well, I'm sure it's dualistic.
Yeah.
Both are true. Both are true. But, so the law is known throughout the world. But Jonah made ready to flee to Tarshish. Well, Tarshish is across the Mediterranean, a southern province of Spain. Jonah was told to go to Nineveh, but he went to Tarshish. Now, what is Nineveh? It is the western suburb. We hear it all the time on TV. It is a western suburb of Mosul, Iraq. And they're driving the ISIS out of the eastern sections of Nineveh, of Mosul, into Nineveh. It still bears that name. But it wasn't too far from Jonah to go from one of the northern tribes over Nineveh. But instead, he went to Tarshish, which is the other side of the Mediterranean.
End of the Mediterranean.
Huh?
You're the end of the Mediterranean, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, down in Spain, Gibraltar is somewhere down there. It's like God telling me to go to Jacksonville, tell them to clean up their act, and I fly to Hawaii. So he was the reluctant prophet. So he went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish, paid the fare, and went down in it to go with them to Tarshish, away from the Lord. How many times have I done that? I would say I've been trying to walk in the Spirit since my second year of medical school. I was invited by a friend to a prayer group in the French Quarter of New Orleans. And I thought, that's an oxymoron.
Yeah.
A prayer group in Sin City. But there were always Assemblies of God preachers out there with a car battery hooked to a cross, a lit up cross, and preaching from the Bible. And St. Paul says, where sin abounds, there grace much more abounds. So I think God planted me in the French Quarter when I was shaky on my own morality. And many times God would tell me things to do, and I wouldn't do it. Now, it's Lent, okay? I've got this little cross here. God and I had a real conversation about wearing this cross to work. And God won out. So at least during Lent, I'm wearing this. Well, women wear crucifixes all the time. And I noticed the veterans have had a little different attitude toward me as I interview them about their disabilities when I'm wearing the cross. I'd say 1 out of 20 veterans will lie to get money. And you say that publicly, oh, but they're a veteran. They earned it. Well, there's only so much money to go around, okay? And a disability is something that keeps you from working or doing other things. And the greater the disability, it goes 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100% disabled. And once you've got your disability rating, the game of many veterans is try to get a higher rating. Now, that sword cuts both ways. You may get the higher rating, but you also might get a lower rating. And my job is to describe things in such a way that the raters in the regional offices, the one we deal with the most is St. Petersburg, can decide how disabled a person is. But they always try to look the sickest they are. In my exam room, when the contract between a doctor and a patient is that the patient wants to be better, now I've got people who want to look sick. Now, some people are right on. Some people are, I call them straight shooters. I said, you're a straight shooter. I went to a medium security correctional institution once and had this wonderful African-American guy, big guy, who was telling me the truth. I said to him, I'm so glad that in these places where there's so many sociopaths, people with antisocial personality disorders that need to stay in prison because they get out and they can't have a relationship with people without trying to get the upper hand. That's what antisocial personality disorder is. I said, I'm so glad you're a straight shooter. He says, have you seen my rap sheet? He began to laugh. You said, read my rap sheet? And I had a rap sheet that my secretary printed off the computer. You can go to the state of Florida and see everybody that's been in prison for the last 20 years and see what they're in for. He said, you looked at my rap sheet, you say I'm a straight shooter? I said, no, I haven't. Assault with a deadly weapon. And I call him a straight shooter. He said, if I were a straight shooter, I'd be a death row. You know, so anyhow, how many times have I not done what God told me to do? Hopefully it's getting less and less. Now, Bob and I have had conversations about this. It seems like the older you get, you peel the onion and you think you get rid of one level of sin that you confess, and then you find a more pungent level right below that. And so as we grow older, it's not unusual to feel even more guilty, which means the sacrament of reconciliation or confession may be even more important as we realize we look back. A guy named Eric Erickson, who was a study of Jung, who was a study of Freud. Freud is the father of psychoanalysis. Jung took Freud's teaching and applied Christian principles to it. So there are a lot of Christians who are into psychology, psychiatry, like Jung. Jung had a student named Erik Erikson, and he established seven levels of personality development. The personality we have as a two-year-old is not a personality I have as a 70-year-old. The last stage in personality development is called integrity versus despair. Integrity versus despair. You look back on your life. Did it have integrity? Did it all fit together? Or despair? Was it all just one big mistake with no meaning at all? Now Nietzsche, the German philosopher, said there's no meaning in it. Nietzsche, who lay awake at night thinking about his life, said, I take comfort in the thought of suicide. And that's where a lot of people go when they think their life is just one big mistake. And unfortunately, young teenagers, with all the, you know, their hormones are raging and their brains are not hardwired. Women's brains get hardwired about age 22, when men's brains don't get hardwired until about age 25. So that's why usually you find younger men married to older women. The other way around. You have younger women married to older men because their brains are wired about the same. Well, that's what happened to Vicki and me. She's 4 years younger than I. And I said to my brothers when I met her in church, why haven't you introduced me to Vicki? He said, well, she's 4 years younger than you. She was in junior high when you were in senior high. You know, you would have had much in common. But with a man who is displaying some unhealthy traits, don't make judgment at all, but wait till 25 and wait till the brain is the machinery of the soul being logic and emotions, higher aspirations, what Freud would have called our superego. What we believe most important about ourselves and our role in life, in our communities. Wait till 25 and see where that young man is. It's no mistake that college and graduate school and professional schools happen in there around before and after the age of 25 when the brain is most sculptable. The brain can be changed. There's a great book I fell into real deep depression in 2000. I had to quit my work as a surgeon. It was just too stressful. It's about how the brain can heal itself. We have billions of synapses where nerve cells join nerve cells, and we're only using about 10% of them. About 90% of our brain is unused, but the brain can be sculpted. And being brought up in a Christian home with morality, the brain is sculpted just by osmosis. A child grows up in a home, and a child will assimilate the behaviors of the parents just by osmosis. My brother-in-law, who lived on Long Island, he said he became a Christian through Saint osmosis by having gone to an Episcopal college. And a joke is, Saint osmosis, he's a relative of Moses. So Jonah's brain had not been sculpted. Of course, this is all maybe fictional. And he goes to the southern tip of Spain, and a great storm brewed out. Then the sailors were afraid, and each one cried to his God. Not Christians, but they knew there was a good and evil thing going on here, like all cultures have, a sense of good and evil. To lighten the ship for themselves, they threw its cargo into the sea. Meanwhile, Jonah had gone down into the hold of the ship and lay fast asleep. The captain of the ship approached him and said, "What are you doing asleep? Get up, call on your God. Perhaps your God will be mindful of us that we will not perish." Then another said to another, "Come, let us cast lots to discover on whose account this evil came to us." Well, that seems sort of suspicious, casting lots. But you know, the remaining 11 disciples, after Judas committed suicide, cast lots to find out who would fill the space that Judas left. So they cast lots. So Christians were doing it in the first Christian century.
What do you mean they were going to call in somebody else to take his place?
Say that again?
Are you saying they were going to call in somebody else to take
his place? Yeah, to take Judas's place.
Oh, okay.
And they cast lots. And a fellow named Matthias got the position. And that's the last you hear of Matthias in the Bible. Okay. The point was, God had other plans. And to fill Judas's place came Saul of Tarsus, who was persecuting Christians, who was on his way to Damascus to persecute more Jews who'd become Christians, when he got zapped by the Holy Spirit halfway there, and he became blind, and he had to be led off to Damascus to the house. I'm not sure, but somebody took him in, and God spoke to a fellow named Ananias. He says, "You go to Paul and tell Saul and tell him his name is going to be Paul, and he's going to do my work, and he will suffer much for my sake." Now, Ananias was not like Jonah. He went and did his job. He went and talked to Saul. Saul regained his sight. He accepted the name Paul, and he became the apostle to the Gentiles. So while we might cast lots, and that's what they did, and came up with Matthias, who you never hear about, God replaced him with Saul, who was killing Christians, became Paul. Saul was actually present at the stoning of Stephen. Saint Stephen was appointed, he was probably the first deacon, appointed to settle disputes between the Greek Christian women, Greek Christian widows, and the Jewish Christian widows. But he was stoned, and Saul stood by and watched him be stoned. So Saul had blood on his hands, and God made him a disciple. It boggles the mind how God will take something that is bad and turn it into good. But that's the story of the crucifixion and the resurrection. What looked bad became powerful. And that's why we celebrate Good Friday, and all of Lent leading up to that, because that's our story. That's our story, how Jesus was crucified. It looked bad. The devil thought he had him under his thumb. He rose 3 days later, like he predicted. The Pharisees came to Jesus and said, "Do us a miracle. Show us a sign." Jesus said, "It's an evil generation that looks for the sign. But the sign that I give you is the sign of Jonah. Tell us your business. Where do you come from? What is your country? And to what people do you belong?" He said, "I am a Hebrew of the northern tribes." Jonah replied, "I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." Now the men were seized with great fear and said to him, "How could you do such a thing?" Here there are pagans, and they know the difference between good and evil. "How could you go against your God that you claim to be so powerful?" They knew that he was fleeing from the Lord, but because he had told them, they asked, "What shall we do with you that the sea may calm down for us? For the sea is growing more and more stormy." Jonah responded, "Pick me up and hurl me into the sea, and then the sea will calm down for you." It's almost the story of Christ. Jonah agreeing for his life to be sacrificed, that these men be saved. Sign of Jonah. "For I knew that this great storm has come about because of me. Still the men rowed hard to return to dry land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more stormy. Then they cried out to the Lord, 'Please, O Lord, do not let us cherish.'" Okay, there's a little evangelism going on here. This Lord is spelled capital L. So they are being led to believe in the God of Jonah by in this terrible situation. And aren't we oftentimes led to God because we're in terrible situations? Kierkegaard, who was Billy Graham, who was Jimmy Carter's favorite theologian, said, "You have to reach rock bottom before you reach out to the Lord." And that's where I was in medical school. But we all get to our rock bottoms, and that's when we call out, "Help me, help me." That's my brother's favorite prayer. Help me, Lord. Help me one more time. If you help me this time, I won't do it again. "Please, O Lord, do not let us perish for taking this man's life. Do not charge us for shedding innocent blood for you. Lord, you have accomplished what you desired." Then they picked up Jonah and hurled him into the sea, and the sea stopped raging. Seized with great fear of the Lord, the men offered sacrifice to the Lord and became and made vows. They became functional Jews. They became pre-Christian, pre-Christ Christians. Jonah's prayer, "But the Lord sent a great fish to swallow Jonah." Now, people say it was a whale. I don't know. Was it a fish? I don't know. Fish do have air bladders where they concentrate gases so they can change depths. The more air they have in their air bladder, and you see it when you clean a fish,
like a
the higher they go.
Like a submarine.
And the less air in their air bladder, the lower they go. And I've had some people who look for scientific explanations of this say, "Well, he got an air bladder." There's a story going around on Facebook about a guy who did get swallowed by a whale for 3 days. It was belched out, and his skin was all digested, so it was white, but he lived. I don't know. This may be allegorical, you know, but anyhow. So Jonah prayed to the Lord, to God, from the belly of the fish. Now the rest is like a song within a story. And you see this a lot in scripture. And sometimes you're reading along, and unless things are set out separate, you don't know it's a song. But it would be a song in Hebrew. Now the interesting thing about Hebrew poetry is it's not so much about rhyming words, it's about an idea being stated in two different ways. The idea is stated one way and then in another. And if you read the Psalms, you see that over and over again. An idea is stated and then it's stated again in a different way, and the two draw contrast to one another. And that's what Hebrew poetry depends on for its rhyming, the rhyming of ideas. So here's a prayer. statement one. Out of my distress I called to you, O Lord, and he answered me. From the womb of Sheol, which is also interpreted later on as netherworld, the Catholic, rather than say hell or Hades, the Catholic scholars have come to call that place where people go that we're not sure about the netherworld. So it could read, from the womb of the netherworld I cried for help and you heard my voice. Boom. You cast me into the deep, into the heart of the sea, and the flood enveloped me. All your breakers and your billows passed over me. Then I said, I am banished from your sight. How will I again look upon your holy temple? The waters surged around me and up to my neck. Here's a second statement of the same idea. The deep enveloped me. Seaweed wrapped around my head. I went down to the roots of the mountains, to the land whose bars closed behind me forever. It's not like a cave, I guess. But you brought me life from the pit, O Lord my God. When I became faint, I remembered the Lord. My prayer came to you in your holy temple. Those who worship worthless idols abandon their hope for mercy, but I, with thankful voice, with sacrifice to you, what I have vowed, I will pay deliverance from the Lord. Then the Lord commanded the fish to vomit Jonah out on dry land. So, it happened that he was headed for Spain and he got vomited out on dry land closer to Nineveh. Sort of like a Greyhound bus, only it had fins, you know. The word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time, set out for the great city of Mosul and announced to it the message that I tell you. So Jonah set out for Nineveh, and according to the word of the Lord, now Nineveh was an awesomely great city. It took 3 days to walk through it. It takes 80 miles to get through Atlanta. Okay. It didn't mean it took 3 days to walk across from boundary to boundary. It took 3 days for him to get around inside the western suburb of Mosul. And he said to them, 40 days more and Nineveh shall be overthrown. The people of Nineveh believed God, and they proclaimed a fast, and all of them, great and small, put on sackcloth. When the news reached the king of Nineveh, he rose from his throne, a pagan, set aside his robe, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat in ashes. Then he made this proclamation throughout Nineveh. By decree of the king and his nobles, no man or beast, no cattle or sheep shall taste anything that shall and shall not eat, nor shall they drink water. They had a fast. Man and beast alike must be covered with sackcloth, call loudly to the God. They must turn from their evil way and from their violence of their hands. Now, the translation of sackcloth to us would be burlap. Imagine wearing burlap and covering yourself with ashes. That's pretty severe. I mean, that'd be a lot harder than wearing this thing.
Why cover your animals?
Well, they would. Burlap was scratchy. It was a way of sort of punishing themselves.
Why would they cover the animals, though? Why?
I don't know.
Doesn't make sense to me.
I don't know. This is poetic, you know. It's fictional, but it tells a story. And the king says, who knows? God may again repent and turn from his blazing wrath so that we will not perish. When God saw by their actions how they had turned from the evil way, the king repented of the evil he had threatened to do to them and did not carry it out. Jonah's anger and God's reproof. But this greatly displeased Jonah. He was sent to have the Ninevites repent so they wouldn't be killed, and then Jonah was angry about it. That's human nature, though. I mean, he was angry that they repented. He was waiting for fire to come down from heaven, boom, like Sodom and Gomorrah. There's a story about Sodom and Gomorrah. So he prayed to the Lord, O Lord, is this not what I said while I was still in my own country? This is why I fled at first toward Tarshish. I know that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger, abounding in kindness, repenting of punishment. So now, Lord, please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live. Jonah would rather die than see the Ninevites repent. But the Lord asks, "Are you right? Do you have a right to be angry?" So Jonah left the city for a place to the east of it, where he built himself a hut and waited under it in the shade to see what would happen to the city. He was still not giving up on them being wiped out. Then the Lord provided a gourd plant. Now this may have some literary meaning that we don't understand. It doesn't translate into our language. A gourd plant, it might have meant something different back thousands of years ago. So God put up a gourd plant to provide Jonah shade to see what would happen to the city. Then the Lord provided a worm that ate the plant, and the plant withered, and then Jonah was back under the punishment of the sun. And then Jonah was angry about that. And then God said to him, "Do you have a right to be angry over the gourd plant?" Jonah answered, "I have a right to be angry, angry enough to die." I've been there. Are we there sometimes? I have a problem with anger. It's genetic. And God said, "You are concerned over the gourd plant, which cost you no effort and which you did not grow. It came up in one night, and in one night it perished. And should I not be concerned over the great city of Nineveh, in which there are more than 120,000 persons who cannot know their right hand from the left, not to mention all the animals?" So God put Jonah in his place, said, "You were angry about the gourd plant, but you weren't worried about the people." So he was a reluctant prophet. But there's a story in that. I know for me, I'm angry when things don't go right in my life. When walking in my baptism, walking wet in my baptism, I am called to be a servant. Jesus says, I came not to be served, but to serve. And he said to James and John, when they wanted to be great in the kingdom, they came to him. One gospel says they wanted to be great in the kingdom. Another says their mother came to Jesus, said, "When you come into your kingdom, and I want my sons to be one at your right, one at your left." They were looking for a political Messiah, somebody to throw off the Romans. And Jesus said, if you want to be great in the kingdom, you must first be a servant. Does all this resonate with y'all?
Some of it, not all of it. When you say it's a story,
what a man, I don't know. There's no specifics here, and again, it's theatrical kind of thing. It's literary kind of thing. Now, Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed by a volcano, a volcanic eruption. And we've seen that. Mount St. Helens, the destruction that happened there. And fire and brimstone is what comes out of a volcano. Sulfur and lava. And there is geographic evidence. Geographic is not geologic. There's geologic evidence. There was a great eruption of volcano near Sodom and Gomorrah around the time in Genesis, it said it would have happened. And the way they've decided this is they've done borings in the Mediterranean. And they can date the sediments to different times in history. And there is a very, very thick volcanic ash sediment that corresponds to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah.
So why would they say she was turned to a pillar of salt if it's lava?
Okay, I forgot my hearing aids.
Maybe I'm thinking of the wrong thing. Wasn't somebody...
No, the pillar of salt was in...
Lot, yeah, Lot's wife.
Lot's wife.
Was that Sodom and Gomorrah?
No, that's different. That's a different.
Where was that?
Well, it was known in Jewish history, and Jesus would refer to it when in Capernaum, his hometown, or Nazareth, Capernaum, around there in Galilee, that's north of Jerusalem, when they didn't believe in him, he said it would be better for those who perished in Sodom and Gomorrah than for this generation.
Oh, okay.
So Jesus even made reference to it. And it was apparently a volcanic eruption that wiped them out, just like Pompeii. You know, this Roman city of Pompeii, okay. People are going about their business, boom! And then it was wiped out. So geology does prove the Bible. There are a lot of incidents of that as they discover new things. They uncovered Hezekiah's water course. When the Assyrians were approaching Jerusalem, Isaiah went to Hezekiah, the king. He was good. He's kind of a, you know, he's a pretty good king compared to some of the others. But he says, we need to get some water into the inside the walls of Jerusalem. And the closest water is the spring and brook at Hebron. We need to get that Hebron water into Jerusalem. So Hezekiah consulted with his combat engineers. And they said, can you bring water? And they said, sure. So they had a line of sight from the wall of Jerusalem to the brook at Hebron. And this is on public television. Public television is proving God. Can you imagine that? So they dug wells down every so often and put a guy at the bottom of the well tapping with a hammer. How'd you like to have that job? Maybe all through the night, tapping with a hammer, you know? Asher might have something to say about that. I don't know, but pop, pop. Well, they were digging from both directions, listening for the sound to give them direction, and they met right in the middle. Now, even the channel was off. You know, the tunnel between France and England, they were, what are we going to do? You know, they were off a little bit. But so they made this water course, but to prevent gravel and dirt from falling into the water, they made a mortar or cement, taking limestone and superheating it with charcoal and adding water to make a paste. And then they use that mortar or that cement to finish the inside of the water course so it wouldn't be dropping debris in. Well, the modern scientists have taken that carbon from that mortar and carbon dated it. And guess what? It goes right back to the date of Hezekiah's reign. So we're studying geologic evidence that there was a Sodom and Gomorrah. We've got geologic evidence that there was Hezekiah's water course, which is mentioned in either 1 Kings or 2 Kings. I don't remember which it was. I think it was 1 Kings. But life is so exciting to see it through God's lenses. When we were going to Servants of Christ Anglican, there was a young woman who had a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in flute performance. But after all that, she decided what she really wanted to be was a midwife. And there's a midwifery school, traditional midwifery here in Gainesville. And, you know, I mean, majority of people ever lived were delivered by midwives. I was considering OBGYN until I got into some OBGYN rotations, 6 weeks in internship, 6 weeks in my general surgery residency. I realized 80% of those babies would come whether a doctor was there or not. It's the 20% where you needed a doctor. And so the nurse midwifery was coming to the fore. So this friend, Caitlin Early, got the degree in midwifery outside the medical profession and saw the writing on the wall because they were having to send so many women who were delivering at home or in the birthing center to the hospital for obstetrical care at the last minute. So she went to Santa Fe and got her pre-nursing requirement, then went to the University of Florida, got her Bachelor of Science in Nursing, and then did a fellowship, become a nurse midwife. And rather than take the job that was offered at University of Florida, she worked for the Mayo outfit up in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And we're friends on Facebook, just like Carol and I are now. And you can go to Caitlin Early's post, Kaitlineerley, mm-hmm. and she's just enthralled how God is portrayed in the process of development of an embryo. Life does start as conception. If you leave it alone, it'll become a baby. It'll become a human being, you know. She's just enthralled with that whole process and then delivering the baby and counseling the mother and then all the changes that go through the mother after all those placental hormones are gone. The progesterone makes you stretchy. Most women will say that in later pregnancy. They just kind of stretched all over the place. And then the placenta was gone and the estrogen progesterone went down and the body went, nope. But not quite to where it was before. But Psalm 19, let's read it. It's today's psalm. And then I've got to go to choir. But, okay, we're going to get into Psalms just a little bit. Oh, it's over here. It comes before Isaiah, becomes before Wisdom, it comes before Song of Songs, which is Song of Solomon. Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is a poetic book, so these poetic books, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, all are grouped together. Psalm 19. God is portrayed in the universe. Paul says this in Romans chapter 1. God is portrayed in the universe. The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament proclaims the work of his hands. Now this is a Catholic translation. I mean, this is what the Catholic scholars believe. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech. Night to night whispers knowledge. There is no speech, no words, no language where the voice is not heard. The report goes forth throughout all the world, their messages to the ends of the world. God has pitched in the heavens a tent for the sun. And this was the old belief that there was kind of a stationary place for the sun. Rather than, you know, the earth was the center of what we thought was the universe, where the sun is the center of ours. Now, Copernicus was excommunicated for believing that the sun was the center of the universe. It was kind of a faux pas.
What's a faux pas?
Huh?
What's a faux pas?
Faux pas is a false move.
Okay.
A false move.
Usually and then they social mistake.
They excommunicated him.
De-excommunicated.
Yeah. Come think about it, Martin Luther's been de-excommunicated.
Has he really?
Why?
The church made a pronouncement.
Yeah, toward the end, he started supporting Mary, where most Protestants don't.
Well, now, in the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church, there is a spectrum from the Pentecostals to the Anglo-Catholics. And that's why Anglicanism and Episcopalian churches are attractive to people. I've met so many couples in Episcopal churches, and Lutheran too, where maybe the wife was raised Catholic and the husband was raised Baptist. And in there, Anglicanism has such a wide, Church of England, mm-hmm. has such a wide spectrum of accepted theology that most people can find, well, not everybody, I won't even say most people, but like a couple who maybe the wife was raised Catholic and the husband Baptist. I know a couple like that. They found the Episcopal Church to be their thing. Now, what sets the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church apart from the Episcopal Church is that Catholics and Lutherans believe in real presence. It is the presence of God in the wafer and the presence of God in the wine. Now, Deacon Henry made distinction between Lutherans. He said, well, when the Lutherans finish with it, they put the wafers back in the cabinet and they pour the wine back in the bottle. Where in the Roman Catholic Church, it all gets consumed or carried to a shut-in. When I was getting over my knee surgery, just no way I could get to church. I tried one time, I was just in so much pain, I had Vicky take me home. The communion in the form of the wafer was brought to me, and the person bearing that has to be very careful not to say that they are bringing communion. They are a function of the church, a tool of the church to connect that person with the larger body of Christ. And so people who are chosen to be these lay Eucharistic ministers, or there's another name for them in the Roman Catholic Church, are very, very special people, that they are so humble that they're bringing communion, is they're bringing that host which attaches them to the home congregation and further that to the whole body of Christ on earth, that ever was and ever will be. When we take communion, but we don't take it, we receive it. It's not something we take, it's something we receive. When we receive communion, we are attached to every Christian that ever was, every Christian that is now, and every Christian that ever will be. And that's why it's such a mystery, and why we regard it with so great care and holiness, the sanctity of it. We are attached by our own blood, like branches on a vine, to the whole Christian church that ever was, is now, and ever will be. So let's go to Mass.
Yeah.
Well, I talked a lot. I didn't.
Thank you, Alfred.
Thank you. I enjoyed doing it.
Thanks, Fred.
It stimulates me to read, and you can keep that stuff on Nineveh. It's very interesting stuff. So.
As I understand it, it keeps you busy, out of trouble, and off the street.
Off the streets and out of pool rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Vicki is always getting me to try to clean up around my easy chair where I have all these papers piled up. She'll be glad that this day came. And we, you know, we can do Psalm 25 some other day.
Sounds
if
good.
If Henry wants me to.
So thanks again, Fred.
He's in prayer for you.